Now that we're back on the air with the drops of knowledge we've come prepared. Hey. Now it's Q2 and we're still afraid that next week our framework will change. Hey. Tell me, did you try out CSS Grid? GraphQL or Clone plugins and check out data sketches, cause they were our latest guests. Tell me, did you build yourself a bot? Or would you rather not? And did you miss us? Well, Tools Day was briefly off the air.
Aww.
Welcome back to Tools Day, a podcast about tech tools, tips, and tricks on Tuesdays at 2. I'm your co-host, Yuna.
And I'm Chris.
And today we're talking about design systems.
Again.
1 year later. Yeah. So our last show on design systems was actually in 2015. It was October 2015, I believe.
That feels like an era ago.
Yeah, because it was an era ago in the dev design world. So we've both still been working on design systems since then. We have a lot more experience and knowledge. It's like, what, 6 years of experience between us? Maybe even more.
Yeah, I've been working design systems in some way, shape, or form, more or less since I joined IBM in a tangential manner until I led the Carbon team, so now in a direct manner. And then my last job, I was trying to kick off a pattern library there as well. So it wasn't called a design system back then. It was just like a shared components, shared patterns.
Yeah, because that's kind of how they started. They started as like more of a design tool. Then they moved to the web. And then they started becoming more integrated to JavaScript and into systems as more component libraries. So I kind of have a similar experience. I have been building design systems for too long. I used to work at a startup where I built like a component library for them, and then I moved to IBM where I was working with Chris, where we met. If you didn't know this, like me and Chris met at IBM working on the design system there for Bluemix.
We would just argue all the time, more or less.
And that's why we have this podcast.
Right.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was a great experience. And then I moved on from there to DigitalOcean, where I was doing a bit of like UI engineering, marketing sites. Then I was working on internal tools. And now I'm back on design systems. Hey!
You can never actually leave. One big circle. People are like, wow, you worked on design systems? How about you do one for us as well?
Right.
And you're like, oh, okay.
And I'm surprised that people are still now building design systems for the first time. But it's definitely something that companies are still coming around to. It has so much benefit to a company when you have this shared tooling. It's just the velocity of development, so many things. And if you want to kind of learn about the basics or intros to design systems and our thoughts on it, maybe our last episode might be better for that. Because in this episode, we want to talk about what we've learned since that time, what it is like to maintain design systems, like what happens after you build it initially, you know? There's a lot of maintenance that goes on. It's not just like one and done. A design system never dies. I recently had a smart quote, I think, and it was, a design system project is finished when your product is finished, because it just doesn't end until you stop building. Yeah, until you stop building new features.
Yeah.
So, Chris has some words of knowledge. I'll just jump in. We're easing back into the podcasting.
Yeah, all right. So let's just kick it off. Okay, so the one thing, you know, I didn't realize really was, you know, you kind of just mentioned the amount of that maintenance was a big thing. I didn't realize how much that was a big thing, right? So, you know, when you're building things, like, oh, I'll just build everything, you know, people will understand it. It's all so simple. You just copy this HTML, copy this CSS, and boom, you're done. But no, it's actually not as simple as it can seem at first. And what we found is that, you know, we're a fairly mature system now, Carbon. We've been around for a year and a half-ish, right?
Recently open-sourced.
Recently open-sourced. And we just open-sourced our React library as well with our React storybook. And we'll be open sourcing a bunch of tools we're building internally. So that's going to be some fun stuff. But
it's going to be exciting. Yeah, I heard about them. We can't talk about them.
I'm super excited about a lot of them. But, you know, the majority of my day now is spent just talking to people and saying, hey, you know, I see you're having a problem with this. How can I help? Or they come to me directly. And I didn't realize how much time that would take out of my every day, right? So the biggest thing I learned really was to invest in really good getting started docs, make them really public, and then constantly iterate over them as you get new people onboarding, because everyone, so IBM is quite large, and so is IBM Cloud, and so you'll have a new team jump on Carbon any given day, and they'll all find some new interesting way to break our carefully written docs. And so it's like, oh, why would you ever do it that way? And they're like, oh, we have this really good reason. It's like, oh, you know, we work in this tightly controlled system. You can only ship these couple things, blah, blah, blah. All these scenarios you can't think about. And so constantly update your getting started docs.
That's tip number one. That's a really good tip. I would also add on to that, because you were talking about how you get a lot of these inquiries all the time. I think a big part of being on a design systems team is education and educating right. the other teams. Like, docs are a great way to write once and not have to deal with it anymore, but that's not really realistic. People are going to ping you. People are going to like ask you questions. I think it'd be ideal if you had somebody who was kind of like the helper on your team with other teams, especially at a company as big as IBM. Currently, I am the design system project at my company.
I am the design system.
hopefully that's not true for very long, but so I get people asking me just small questions all the time. Like, is oftentimes they're just missing something in right. another section of documentation. So yep. once they ask that question, that means somebody else probably had the question too. And that's a good point at which you can make a ticket and update your docs.
Right.
Aside from that, it's still helpful to kind of like, especially in the beginning, go over with teams. Like, this is what, you know, our design system is. This is how it works. Just like one quick overview. And then people are more likely to use it because they know it exists and it's on the periphery.
Yeah, and speaking of having someone just be there to answer questions, it's also really important to have outreach teams, like a marketing team for your internal system, right? That you go out and you sell your system to your teams that are using them, just because, you know, everyone has different needs and requirements, and it's important for you as a design system team to be really responsive to that, because you're there to help other people work faster, right? And if you don't, you know, if you're not receptive to people's needs and requests, it's a quick way to make your system not actually be used, right? And then it kind of goes south from there. And, you know, we've talked to a bunch of different design system teams outside of IBM, internal IBM, and this is kind of the one commonality that of successful ones, that you have kind of a council or like a town hall or like open office hours or some way to kind of talk to every team that's using your system internally and just be aware of, you know, the problems we're facing or new requirements that pop up. Because as a product grows, you know, you're going to have new UIs, and how do you handle new UIs in your design system is kind of a challenge and something you'll have to face.
Yeah, that's definitely a good point. Kind of tangential to that is a lesson that I've learned, especially at IBM, when I first started working on design systems, and that was that your idea of what it should be is not what people are expecting or what they hope to use. Like, every developer has their own idea of what is easy for them to use, what integrates into their system. There are so many different systems people are working in. So all you can do is really make sure that you listen to those needs and you develop to those needs. Like, when we first started the design system at IBM, it was very like SaaS driven and like, you know, it was made for somebody who was really focused on kind of the same skill set that a lot of the people who were working on the product also had. But that's not true in the real world. In the real world, right. it's probably somebody who doesn't have much experience with front-end development even. They're just wanting right. to integrate their back-end system and give it a visual aspect, like some kind of GUI.
Right.
And they just want the copy and paste code. And that's really right. it. So you have to be able to ship to these different audiences, the people who really want customization. You know, they can, you know, include the smallest amount of CSS and like get everything perfect and nice and neat and extend your components. And then there's also developers who just want to bootstrap, you know?
Right. And you know, we sometimes don't like that. We have all these industry best practices in our head. Like, oh, we're going to compile the smallest amount of CSS. We're going to use Webpack and we're going to use like Purify CSS. We're going to like optimize web bundles. We're going to just do these all these things. But the reality is that many teams have one developer, no designers, maybe like two OMs for some reason, two operating managers or product managers, and who all want to ship something tomorrow. And, you know, enabling developers to ship is more important than having the absolute perfect, pristine thing in the world.
Yes. Yes. I so agree with this. And you can be held back, honestly, held back so much in your product development if you're so focused on your ideal vision. You have to focus on what people want, not what you like, not what you don't like. It's about what makes it easier for the developers. It's all about the DX, really.
Right. Developer experience. Okay. You know, I had never heard the term DX until recently, and I've seen it pop up in Twitter a bunch. I'm like, what are all these people saying, DX? I'm old now, apparently. Oh, God. You kids and your acronyms. But no, that's such a – I think that's almost one of the – biggest takeaways is that you have to realize that, you know, for people who are so invested in front of the community, you pick up all these cool things, these bleeding edge technologies, and then you realize that you're the only one doing it, and the vast majority of people aren't doing that. They're still using jQuery. They're still using, which is not bad, you know, no hate to jQuery. jQuery solved a lot of problems for a lot of people. It's quite small now. But all these developers and designers who just need something to help them out. And so the role of the design system is to accelerate good design and good practices, enable people to build the best ones if they have the skill set for it, but allow anybody to create something that matches, you know, your company's brand, you know, standards, design set practices and whatnot like that.
Yeah. Kind of along those lines, it's not like really a lesson learned, but it's just a note to take. If you're going to be building a design system, if you already have one, you should really be focusing on accessibility and performance. Because if you don't include that and your team is using this design system, then you're exacerbating the problem with every single iteration, every single use of your design system. You want to make sure that this is a product that people are using for good and with, you know, all the best practices in mind, if it's going to be used as it should, and that's going to be to like 10x your developer experience, product build, etc. So just make sure that's on the forefront at all times. Like, accessibility, test your design system, make sure you are testing all the time, constantly.
So we'll be rolling out a blog post about how we integrate A11 into our development pipeline. And I think the big thing is that accessibility does not have to be super hard, right? There are things you need to keep in mind as you develop, and it's a skill set, definitely. But once you kind of mesh yourself into it, it's not one of those things where you're like, oh, wow, this is going to take... I feel like there's a stigma that making a site accessible or making a post accessible will take years, right? It'll take so much work.
Well, it does,
right?
If you don't do it in the first place.
Yeah,
that's
and it does.
Where you get
but,
stigma, because it's true. If you don't...
Absolutely, apply. Yeah. But in a design system where you're building these sandbox components, you have the opportunity to kind of test these components early on, right? And build these building blocks that are already accessible out of the box, and then enable your UI to have that much of a leg up as they get started on doing the same A11 stuff. And so, one of the things that helps a lot with that is. Like I just said it is integrating the stuff into your developer environment. And so as you develop code, just like having tests that run whenever you write JavaScript, you should have tests that run on at your HTML and say, all right, is my HTML and CSS actually accessible to somebody, right? There's a great tool called Axe.
Oh, we use Axe too.
Capital X, yeah, Axe Core. And then Axe, there's a Gulp plugin called Gulp Axe WebDriver.
CLI also.
The Axe community is amazing. They have so many tools, and one of our developers, Brian Hahn, who was on our show 2015.
Oh, yeah, about we talked about the first time.
Right?
Yeah.
He was beatboxing for us back then. It was great. put that through all of our stuff, and it's so helpful. You kind of see all these things right away, and I think that really helped out on some of our processes for building for accessibility.
Yeah, nice.
Let's see. Speaking of tools, more tools. Tools Day.
That's what we're all about.
One of the big things we realized too late is that we didn't automate enough of our stuff early on, right? The biggest one is releases. If people contribute to your library. Yeah, if people are getting excited about your library, they contribute to your library, they make a PR. The PR is merged in, and then you're slow about actually releasing the code. It's such a huge momentum breaker, right? And so this was a problem that was really my fault for a while, because I was super slow about releasing new code. We do it like once a week, once every 2 weeks. There's no real cadence. And so we swapped to this tool called Semantic Release. Kent Dodds is kind of promoted it in his How to Open Source a Library, egghead.io talk. And it is amazing. It's made everything so much faster for us. Every PR to master, basically, once it's merged in, is automatically released, versioned and released.
Ooh, I need this because so I always forget. And then yeah, I have to do another pull request. It's just like,
right. I don't have to worry about that anymore. No one has to worry about it, right? So it's just really quick and super nice. So invest in automation super early, especially with releases, because people will get on you if you don't release fixes or features fast enough. So
okay, so a point that I meant to make when we were talking about accessibility, I totally like got thrown off, and then I was like, okay, nice. But I meant to say something. I wanted to say that while you're testing, there are really easy like surface level tests that you can do. Like when you run this thing through a accessibility tester on your web page, you can use plugins for that. But you can't as easily test for focus and for different JavaScript interactions. So make sure that you do have unit tests and you have different kinds of tests that you're applying to any interactive elements when you're building a pattern library. Because again, that kind of code is what is going to grow and multiply. As people build onto it and people build more complex interactions with your base elements, make sure that you're including accessibility testing for those interactions, for checking focus state, for other things like making sure you can escape with the escape key. Like those are all like WCAG requirements that people don't always know about. We should probably do another accessibility show. I think that might be good.
Yeah, I know, right? I've learned a lot since our last one, honestly.
Same. It just keeps growing.
The one that we forgot about a bunch was any click handler has to also happen. Yeah, I'm like, no, Hangouts, stop. Click handler has to also have some sort of keyboard thing with it as well, right? And so we forgot about that a bunch until I integrated this automated, JSX, React.js or React Ally JSX ESLint thing.
Yeah, it's especially important if you're using something like React, if you're like rebuilding the DOM, sort of. Not sort of, you're rebuilding the DOM. So you have to be especially on point about this.
Right.
So yeah, it's good that there are those tools for all of that.
Yeah. And it just pops up into your editor, right? And for me, the best way of warning anything is in my editor itself, so I can see it as I'm running code. So just like how ESLint says, hey, by the way, you forgot a semicolon, you forgot this. With that kind of tool integration, you can see, oh, I forgot to add the ARIA label, or I forgot to add the description, or whatever it is, right? And so those are super crucial.
Okay, so that brings me to another point. See, I didn't have to have notes for this. I just like remember so many things. I also love my editor as my main source of error handling because it's just immediate, it's direct, everything. And you can document that for team members, etc. But when you're building a design system, you don't always know everybody who's using it, especially at a larger company. So what's really beneficial to that is if you have sort of continuous integration testing, like on pull request level for those sorts of things like accessibility and various tests, whatever you have set up for your library. That way, you don't have to expect somebody else to change their setup, but they will be notified at some point, and that point is before they can get a pull request merged. CLI tools are also helpful, but they can get lost in the mix as things are like reloading and you're like seeing that command line refresh. So I think that like CI tests are really good for this specifically.
Yeah, we also have a post commit hook that happens for our lint, or not, for our style, our JavaScript styling. So we use Prettier now, and Prettier is this newish syntax formatter released by Jay Longster, I believe.
I don't know what we use. We have a syntax formatter, and it does give you errors, so it might be a similar thing.
So ESLint does that. So ESLint gives you the errors as well as formats them with the ESLint --fix. The Prettier one is just a better version of that.
Why is it better? Tell me more.
it's super nice. So Prettier uses this thing called abstract syntax tree, ASTs, to kind of break down your code and then reformats it in a certain way that Prettier has specified. So it's not as flexible as ESLint. So ESLint has like every rule in the book. Prettier has like 5 configuration points, although it's growing now. So this is how we'll format your code. And it does it automatically on save or wherever else you kind of tell it to. and it has really sped up our development time by a substantial amount. We no longer think at all about style because Prettier solves all of it for us on save. We have an ESLint Prettier config more or less that says, okay, still check for, you know, errors in your code with ESLint, but any style is handled by Prettier. This kind of goes back to an older day. So back in the, you know, 2005 to 10 to 11, not that time, but like
2005 was a while ago. That was 12 years.
Yeah, you know, so many times we had JSLint, right, which just checked for JavaScript errors and not for style. And when ESLint came around, it was because, oh hey, we also want to check for style. But now with Prettier, I use Prettier for style and ESLint just for errors. And so it's kind of a
okay.
Everything old is new again thing, but
I still use ESLint for all the things, but maybe I'll try Prettier out.
Check out Prettier. It's super nice. So what we've done actually is that we've added Prettier as a command line tool that's run off after every commit. So if you make a commit to our library, it will go through and Prettierify your JavaScript code so that it looks like.
So it does it automatically.
Code. Does it automatically.
I don't know how I feel about that.
It's one of those things that it's way... So one of the issues we were having is that people trying to contribute to our library, you know, it would error out in Travis because of the linting error. That's really frustrating for a lot of people. Like, oh, I did all this work, and there's just some semicolon error, and now I have to run and fix it, and then run it all over again. And it's like a small thing that people got grumpy about. And with this, you know, fix on commit thing, that never is an issue again, right?
I could see that being a benefit, but I feel like it's almost better when somebody is notified because they can learn from it. And sure, well, they can be grumpy, yeah. But they don't even know they made a mistake if it's automatic.
It's such a conversation I had with a bunch of people. It's this kind of war between do I educate people or do I make the developer convenience higher?
Both.
And there's a both as well. The Prettier on commit will tell them, hey, we've processed your code, right? But it won't show you what they've done. I mean, I personally prefer the Prettier on save, so you can kind of see immediately what happens. But even that is automagical, right? It doesn't tell you.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not perfect, too. Like, I used to use CSS Comb.
Prettier is perfect.
Well, once upon a time, there was CSS Comb, and it didn't really work that well. It worked well, but then when you started to do more complex things, like nesting with ampersands right. And like sass, it just didn't work great.
And I agree with
you. I'm worried that Prettier might be great now, but when's, you know, in the future, I don't know. I kind of like seeing what it's telling me.
You know, I agree with you on one side, but and so that was kind of the point that was the counterpoint we had, but the speed of development was just so nice. It was like, oh man, I have this ternary expression. It's kind of complicated. It's kind of hard to read. I just press save, and then suddenly it's so readable. It's so nice.
Oh, that
to see.
Is nice.
Just,
I like that.
It's just like it's like witchcraft. Like,
I get wow, it. So I'm nice. Torn. I get it.
I encourage anyone who's not tried Prettier, just try it out.
You know, I will try it. I will.
I think like once you see it in action, especially with a bigger code base, it's like you know you sometimes you're going through some you know tutorials online. You copy some code into your editor. Looks ugly, and you're like, oh, this sucks. But with Prettier, I just press save, and suddenly it's so pretty.
Okay,
it's just wonderful.
I'm writing it down.
So, try it out, Prettier, fantastic.
We'll link it in the show notes. Yeah. I'm sold. Yeah. Okay, so any other things we kind of want to talk about?
Oh man, I mean, I can talk about random things we've learned all day, really.
I want to talk about something that I didn't really get to experience at IBM, and I'm going to have to deal with this very, very shortly, and that's when you are building something not for only new products. Like, design systems right now we're building, and it's easier to go forward and have brand new and, like, move ahead with the product. But now I'm building this design system to refactor our existing product. And that is a way bigger challenge, I think, because you have to think about, okay, we have all these components. What's the latest version, right? So you have to go through and audit every single dropdown, every single button, every single interactive element, and decide what is the like example that we're going to put in our component library. And then you have to break that down and say, okay, what's the smaller component within this? Like, we have like these tables of droplets that aren't actually tables. So we've decided to make a new component and call it object list. And like, you have to go through and make these decisions. And that's just step one. Step two is then integrating.
Naming is so hard.
Naming is so hard. Earlier today, I was working on form spacing. And it was, so I wanted to create a class that you can just put on the entire form, not think about the spacing. And then one that you could be more granular and do it on every single row. And so it's like, what do you call form spacing row versus form spacing form? Like,
oh man, it's so hard. Like, it's one of those things why I think a month ago or 2 months ago, we had Glenn Mattern on about CSS and JavaScript, and I was not sold at all, really. But one thing that it does really well is that you don't have to worry about naming things anymore.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
Like, it just like names it for you.
Which, naming is fun.
I'm like, oh, that's so nice. But anyways, this wasn't true when you were here, but since after you left, we had to deal with that issue, that very issue where we had a bunch of other teams onboarding into Carbon, and they all had existing code bases. They could be from any different framework, and it was like, okay, how do we deal with them? Also, how do we deal with products that are existing right now that are not Bluemix per se? So Carbon was built for Bluemix specifically, but it's kind of expanding a little bit in its nature, and so we're like, okay, how do you deal with this whole suite of products that have a whole bunch of different designs, but they all have dropdowns? Do we use the Carbon dropdown, or do we have a merger of dropdowns, or do we have some sort of theme? We just built theming into Carbon, but it's one of those things that are like, oh wow, there's so much like design work, not even development, yeah, just designers kind of hammering out, okay, what goes where? And then you go to the developer and you're like, okay, now I have this new design, how do I integrate it to my current application?
So the namespacing helps a lot there.
Yeah, and so we namespace every class in Carbon. So everything has a BX dash dash. And it's so ugly. Like, you look at it and you're like, man, I wish I could say dropdown, but I have to say BX dash dash dropdown. So irritating. But it's like a lifesaver for a lot of people.
That's definitely true when you have a lot of different code bases and you don't really have a hand in refactoring them all. I think the refactoring is very time consuming. At a point, you have to serve multiple CSS files because you have your new version and your old version, then it takes a while to clean it up and you have these weird errors, and I don't know what the best solution to that is yet, but it's a reality for a lot of teams that are, you know, working on existing systems and building design systems.
So the one thing that you just have to be cognizant of is, like, don't be surprised that people aren't adopting your system all at once. Like, application work takes time. Like, so we shipped a version 7 of Carbon 2 months ago or so, but we don't expect anyone to be fully transitioned over for like a good 6 to 8 months, right? Because it's a commitment to make. You know, I need to dedicate time and resources to the UI that could be doing something else. You know, updating versus adding new features, blah, blah, blah. So, it's just, I think sometimes I see these unrealistic timelines that people have. Like, oh, I'll build a design system and then next month everyone will be using it. And I was like, no, it takes time. There's a year or two process to get everything going.
A really good time to launch a design system internally is before a hackathon, because everybody at that point is going to be building a new product over whatever, like, 2 days you have, and they want something like this for their UIs. Also, you get user feedback like immediately. So if you could have a hackathon for your company and be kind of like a liaison of not like... You can do your own hack, but also be available for help. You'll get the best user feedback.
Yeah. Plus, we got like a lot of first-time users, which is the best feedback. Like, you need to, like, any design system's first impression is so crucial, because if they don't love it at first, or it's too hard at them at first, like, it's so hard to get people to change.
If they don't like it at first, they're not going to use it. They're just going to revert and say, "We don't need this. I did the research and development." Decided not worth it.
We're like, oh, we'll just use Bootstrap.
And there are so many other reasons to use it. Ugh, they're so... Right. Okay, so I think we might be over time, actually. I don't know if we are.
I think we're over time, but that's fine.
We can keep talking about this stuff forever. TLDR, issues arise that you're not expecting, and you got to work with them.
That's a great TLDR, right? Support matters. Be nice to your teammate, to your external teams. Constantly reach out for feedback and integrate that feedback into your loop. And don't be stressed out when people think something's bad from you.
Right? Yeah, it's not. They're not mad at you. They're not mad at anything. They're just frustrated because they are not used to the system yet.
Right.
So, just know the design systems are messy. It's not a clean cut. There's no unless you're building a brand new product, and before you've even started building the product, you've built a design system.
Which is a terrible way of doing it, sidebar.
Because you don't even have components you're building from anyway. But, that's also an ideal world that doesn't exist.
Right.
You're always going to have some kind of clash, and it's worth it in the end once you've refactored, once you've got the system going. It makes such a big difference in velocity, in improving overall accessibility and performance, and, a shared language among developers across teams. It's so good, especially if your product is growing, which, is generally a good thing.
Yeah.
So
that's that, I guess. Welcome back.
Yeah, we're back. Thanks for joining us. Remember, we do have a Patreon if you want to support the show. It's patreon.com/toolsday. We have our Twitter account, which is just @toolsday, and you can find us on toolsday.io, which is our site. Subscribe to the RSS feed and you won't have to go there. But yeah, leave comments, reviews on all your favorite systems, like
podcatcher of choice, as Dave Rupert would say.
iTunes is good. Yeah, and
people still use iTunes.
Yo, I do for podcasts.
Okay, never mind.
We'll see you next time.